Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for June 2018, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. My interview this month is with Michael Benson about his book Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Celebrating the 50th anniversary of the film's release, this is the definitive story of the making of 2001, A Space Odyssey, acclaimed today as one of the greatest films ever made, including the inside account of how director Stanley Kubrick and writer Arthur C. Clarke created this cinematic masterpiece. Regarded as a masterpiece today, 2001 received mixed reviews on its 1968 release. Despite the success of Dr. Strangelove, director Kubrick wasn't yet recognized as a great filmmaker, and 2001 was radically innovative with little dialogue and no strong central character. Although some leading critics slammed the film as incomprehensible and self-indulgent, the public lined up to see it. 2001's resounding commercial success launched the genre of big-budget science fiction spectaculars. Such directors as George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Ridley Scott, and James Cameron have acknowledged its profound influence. I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, in 1968, the year it opened at the Summit Cinerama Theater in downtown Detroit. I was all of 13 years old or so, and the film completely blew my mind. I did not understand by any means everything that was happening in the film, but I honestly didn't care. It was one of the most profound cinematic experiences in my lifetime. I began my interview with Michael Benson by asking him how old he was when he first saw 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I was six, and by the way, I agree with you entirely about having my mind blown and not knowing what I'd seen, but not caring. And I've been making the point that, you know, there is incomprehension at a film that leads to irritation, and there's incomprehension at a film which produces wonder, or wonder which produces incomprehension. I'm not sure which. And 2001 is certainly in the latter category.
It's so true. I mean, even the most casual of fans of 2001 or a film know the name Stanley Kubrick. Not everybody is so familiar with Arthur C. Clarke. Tell us a little bit more about Arthur C. Clarke and how he came to collaborate with Stanley on 2001.
Well, Arthur Clarke actually is quite well known, certainly among people who are interested in science fiction and spaceflight and so forth. He is considered one of hard science fiction's big three, mid-20th century big three, and along with Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. And by hard science fiction, I mean science fiction that is solidly grounded in actual science, in physics, the laws of physics, and so on, as opposed to fantasy, you know, the J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis school of writing. And Clarke, apart from writing such major works as Childhood's End and 2001, the novel, and various other excellent works of fiction, including lots of short stories, Clarke was a major advocate for spaceflight way before there was spaceflight. So he was one of those space geek kids, really, in the UK in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, advocating for rocketry and spaceflight and so forth.
So it was Stanley Kubrick who initially reached out to Arthur C. Clarke, knew how important he was as a writer, and what was the original correspondence between Stanley Kubrick and Arthur Clarke?
Yeah, well, that was part of the fun of researching this book, I have to say. I got to look at all of those original letters and tables and telexes. You know, we're talking way pre-email. And fortuitously, Arthur kept on jetting back to Colombo, Sri Lanka, then called Ceylon, and that forced them to communicate in a way that could be archived for later research. What was it like? Well, they had a very equal creative discussion that went on for 4 years. equal in the sense that they were intellectual equals, and each brought things to the conversation that the other didn't have. Of course, in the second half of those 4 years, it was really Kubrick's baby, and he was building it and shooting it and, you know, directing it and producing it. But the ideas behind 2001 were very much jointly conceived and grounded in work that Clark had been doing for a couple decades previously. So 2001 is very much a collaboration, and the authorship has to be understood as belonging to both.
Hmm. Now, where was Stanley Kubrick in his career at this time as he was embarking on 2001? What had he just made, and was he doing well in his film career?
Oh, he was doing spectacularly well, which is why MGM came up with the funds for such a big budget production as 2001. He had just released Dr. Strangelove in the spring, early spring of 1964, and it got, not only was it a critical hit, it was a commercial success, and it was very controversial because it was very anti-establishment and very, you know, critical, really, of the military-industrial complex and all that. I mean, Dr. Strangelove is one of the greatest anti-war satire, black satires ever made, if not the greatest. And so he had had commercial success and critical success with the film immediately prior to it. But apart from that, you know, he had shown Hollywood that he could handle directing a truly big budget film when he was brought by Kirk Douglas on to direct Spartacus. This is in the late 50s, which was, you know, a truly big budget production. And he really brought that off really well, and it got a number of Oscars and was well-regarded, commercial success, and so forth.
It's incredible in your book, Michael, to read about how so much of 2001, that the plot was up in the air and made up, you know, as they went along. You've got this big, big budget film directed with this indie, low, almost, you know, low budget art film philosophy, you know, as if, you know, as if Jean-Luc yeah. Godard, who was famously known for, you know, scribbling notes the night before and, okay, the day of shooting, here's what we're doing now, and now we're going to change it, and let's try this. But yeah, you're talking about, you know, a big, big budget film. The MGM execs, did they know this? They must have been freaking out from the beginning, right? Were they not allowed on the set?
It's a great question. And actually, MGM, one reason that Kubrick was shooting in the UK was to have as much distance between himself and the studio as possible.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't mean they didn't know what was going on, because it was the MGM studios in Boreham Wood, north of London, and, you know, obviously they had sources of information. The MGM president and CEO, Robert O'Brien, was one of the unsung heroes of 2001, in that even though he must have known about a lot of improvisation going on in Boreham Wood on the 2001 shoot, he had faith. He really had faith in Stanley Kubrick. And so he simply served as the kind of, you know, he was the guy running interference for Stanley when it came to people at MGM who might have been skeptical about the project. But you're right that, and also I should say this, the MGM executives had access to the sets. They did fly in periodically. They were shown material. They toured the sets. So it wasn't quite as kind of draconian as later shoots where Kubrick notoriously didn't allow Warner Brothers executives onto the sets of some of, you know, The Shining and so on. So they did have some access. As to your larger question about improvisation on the set, you're right. It was kind of Godardian. It was an art film mentality in a way, at the service of this big budget epic vision. You know, as I pointed out in my book, in a lesser mind than Stanley Kubrick's, this could have resulted in a kind of Heaven's Gate-style disaster.
Sure.
But in Kubrick's mind, it actually resulted in his refining the concept and, you know, whittling away extraneous elements and removing overt exposition, resulting in you know, a kind of masterpiece of ambiguity. I mean, you know, you don't know exactly what some of those sequences mean, but again, you know, that doesn't result necessarily in confusion and resentment. It's more wonder and wonder at the mystery of what has been produced.
The special effects in this film still look so state of the art. And when you think we're talking 50 years ago, which is really an eternity when it comes to technology, how did he accomplish some of these things? Can you give an example? Like, how did he make us really feel like we were in outer space? I mean, this was just a fiendishly complex production design with some of these special effects. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, I've got a nice scene in my book where Jeffrey Unsworth, the director of photography of 2001, is walking towards the restaurant on the facilities with Roger Karras, who was Kubrick's vice president and close associate. And Karras noticed that Unsworth, who was, you know, mid-career, in his 50s, had shot many, many films. Unsworth was looking very thoughtful and meditative, and he said, "So, Jeffrey, what do you, why so contemplative?" And Unsworth thought about it for a minute, and then he turned to Karras, and he said, "You know, I've been a top British cinematographer for decades. I've been a top man. I've shot over 30 films. If you had told me before I met Stanley Kubrick that I had anything more to learn about cinematography, I would say you're joking. But I have learned more from that kid," and he was talking about Kubrick, "in the last few months than I did in the entirety of my prior career. He's absolutely the best when it comes to issues of photography, you know, cinematography, depth of field, color emulsions, et cetera, et cetera." And then he said, "Do you realize that?" he said to Roger Karras. And I think that's the key to how they brought off such a such an utterly convincing film depicting technologies, you know, launching into space and flying through space 30 years in the future of their production, meaning in the year 2001. Kubrick was simply absolutely incapable of tolerating the slightest compromise when it came to realism. And so he ensured, first of all, he ensured that everything was first generation on the negative. So you didn't have, this is pre-digital. I hope I'm not getting too technical.
No,
here,
not so far.
Okay. Well, it was pre-digital, which meant, you know, the only way to have a spaceship and a planet and, you know, a foreground object or something, you know, in the same shot was either you did optical printing, which is what they were doing in those 1950s and most 1960s science fiction films, and the result was higher grain. You know, it was just an obvious, it was transmitting to the audience, this is a visual effects shot.
You know, yeah,
this is fake, right? But one way they avoided this problem is by using the original negative and running it through the camera multiple times so that you always had everything on the original source negative. And that was very, very tricky, of course, to bring off.
Right.
That was one way they did it.
Because if you are doing, the fifth pass or the sixth pass, and then you screw something up, you've got to go back to the beginning, correct?
No, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
But by the way, if I may say, another reason that film is utterly convincing today is that Kubrick and Clark went to the top people in the business, and by business I mean not film business, but the technology business. They went to MIT, they went to Bell Labs, they went to IBM, and they consulted with the best people, best futurists and technologists then working. You know, people like Elliot Noyes, you know, the IBM designer who was responsible for not only the corporate logos and so forth of IBM in the 60s, but also the IBM Selectric typewriter. And I kind of made the point in my book that Elliot Noyes was running the equivalent of the Apple Design Bureau of the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
So he went to the top people and asked them for their advice on what would these spacecraft systems look like. And you know, they really listened and they incorporated these ideas. So, for example, Bell Labs suggested that they had many, many large flat screen displays arranged around, you know, their interiors, spacecraft interiors. And, you know, we're talking mid-60s, a time when CRT TVs were making the transition from black and white to color. You know?
Right.
So they took that advice seriously. And as a result, if you look, as you pointed out rightly, if you look at 2001 today, you know, there are not many indications that this film was made 50 years ago. It still looks futuristic.
It does. And arguably the most indelible, most memorable character in the film is a computer, is HAL. Where did the idea of HAL 9000 come from? Is that Kubrick's alone or Kubrick and Clark?
It was definitely Kubrick and Clark discussing ways in which they could incorporate robotics and so forth into their film. And in fact, the HAL 9000 computer started out as a kind of a not very intelligent robot, you know, probably with origins in Isaac Asimov's fictions. You know, he wrote the iRobot series of short stories, which are really great. And then it moved from being a robot as they sought advice from those companies and institutions I already mentioned, including, by the way, Marvin Minsky of the MIT, you know, who was co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab in the 60s. As they sought advice from some of these institutions, it became, an organization, it became a mainframe computer. The robot turned into a mainframe computer called Athena, named with a female voice, named after the goddess who saved Odysseus from many predicaments in the Odyssey. And then that later became an AI easily capable of passing the Turing test, meaning, you know, capable of passing for sentient and in fact, sentient AI.
When you revisit 2001, one is always struck by how little dialogue there is in the film, though, and how much the film is conveyed visually. Was it always Kubrick and Clark's intention to have the visuals tell the story primarily and really keep the dialogue through much of the film to a minimum?
Well, it definitely wasn't Clark's intention. Clark was a writer.
Right.
Clark, was used to expressing himself in words. And in fact, Clark was writing voiceover narration up until, you know, late December of 1967, just a few months before the film was released, he was still working on voiceover narration, but Kubrick elected not to use it. When it came to the dialogue, Kubrick shot a lot more of it than he ended up using. And, but even when he was shooting it, it was quite banal. You know, it was not intended to, say much apart from that people were communicating in this kind of tech speak, techno speak, and kind of the same banal way that they were in the 60s, you know, so it's true that the dialogue, the words of the film are not as important as what you're seeing with your eyes, apart from the HAL human dialogues, which are key. So, for example, there's that epic scene when HAL is being deprogrammed by Dave Bowman, you know, the last surviving astronaut.
Yes.
After HAL had killed off the rest of the crew. And he's begging for his life, effectively, you know, saying, "Stop, Dave, I can feel it. My mind is going." So in that scene, the dialogue couldn't be more important. It's more of a monologue, actually, by HAL. But, you know, I think that Kubrick's intention, certainly as it evolved, was to create a film. The way he put it later, I think in 68, is he said it puts audiences in the unaccustomed position of having to pay attention with their eyes.
Yes.
Film is a visual medium, and after sound was introduced into film in the 20s, films started becoming very static, and they became filmed plays, effectively. And Kubrick was, in a way, taking it back into this space where visual storytelling was up front and the words were secondary.
How far over budget did the film go, and did the how far over the original shooting schedule did they end up going during the making of this film? It must have just been devilish trying to get everything finished and complete, especially when, you know, Stanley Kubrick was so open to different ideas throughout the course of the production.
Yeah. They more than doubled the budget. The initial budget in the contract was $5 million. And the final budget, you know, the estimate of what they ended up spending varies somewhere between 11 and 12 and a half million.
And what is that in today's money, yeah, approximately? What would that be?
So if you multiply that times seven and a half, you get to today's dollars. So we're talking about 85 to 90 million dollars. And, you know, that is getting up towards a James Cameron budget. And in fact, if you consider that Kubrick very intentionally didn't cast big name stars in the film because he didn't want to spend money on them. And so with some James Cameron films, a good part of the budget, you know, went to paying the stars. And Kubrick didn't have big name stars, as I just said.
Right.
So as a result, I mean, I would say that it is a James Cameron budget, really.
Mm-hmm. So the first screening of 2001, A Space Odyssey, was for executives at MGM, and it sounds like it was essentially a complete disaster, with many people thinking that Kubrick's career was ruined. Take us into that screening. When was that, and where was that, Michael?
Well, the actual first screening in Culver City, you know, in the MGM facility in L.A., was just for the inner circle of top MGM executives, and they were sitting in the front rows with Stanley.
Oof.
You know, and then you had a couple editors like David DeWild and Ray Lovejoy, the editors, you know, editor and his assistant, were sitting in the back rows, and then there were a couple people up in the booth, and that was it. And David DeWild told me that his perception when the lights went back up was that it didn't go over well at all with the MGM executives. But he couldn't confirm that because he had to go run up to the booth in order to get the film reels back from the projectionist. So he went up to the booth. He discovered that he was shaking from the tension of the, you know, of the event. He had been working with Stanley for years on the film, and he was aware about how high the stakes were. And then he got up to the booth, and he saw, to his surprise, he saw this guy in his late teens there who, you know, immediately started interrogating him about the film and who he was and so on. So it turned out it was the nephew of one of the MGM executives. And he said, you know, he said, so what did you think? He, you know, David DeWild, assistant editor of 2001, asked the nephew of the MGM executive who had stowed away in the booth. He'd been allowed to see the film kind of between the lines, you know, asked him what he thought. And the kid said, it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
There
you
go.
You immediately have this kind of dichotomy between the older established types up front who seemingly didn't get it and the younger generation that was absolutely blown away by it. And so I think that your question, though, was referring to the initial preview screenings and premieres, where you had you know, packed audience, packed theaters, and a lot of walkouts, and MGM executives considering it an utter disaster, and negative reviews, and you know, highly agitated audiences, or you know, uncomfortable audiences, a lot of whom left, as I just said. So that was, you know, the premieres were a disaster and the reviews were highly negative at first. And then Kubrick ended up cutting 20 minutes from the film.
Yeah, what did he take out? Do we know exactly what he took out primarily from the film? Yeah, that's a fair chunk of time.
Well, we know, if you read my book, you'll see that there were redundant scenes that, because Kubrick, you know, that screening that I described earlier, for the MGM executives, was the first time the director saw his own film from beginning to end with all of the effects shots in.
Wow.
And that was 10 days before the premiere.
Oof.
And so he just had no time to do test screenings or to evaluate his own work.
Ugh.
And there were a couple redundant scenes in the film which caused audience squirming. You know, as Roger Karras put it, Kubrick was prowling the theater at the New York premiere trying to assess the audience squirm factor. So, for example, in the first shots of this giant Discovery spacecraft, which is bound for Jupiter, a nuclear-powered spacecraft, you see this wondrous shot, really, with the astronaut jogging in circles in the centrifuge, this kind of hamster wheel set. So he seems to run upside down and then right side up and sideways and so on in a circle as he jogs around the centrifuge, Ferris wheel kind of construction. And that's an amazing shot. But then Kubrick made the mistake of repeating it 10 minutes later with the other astronaut doing the same thing. And so that's where the audience started to get upset, And, of course, add to that the fact that, as we just discussed earlier, it's a largely wordless, very abstract, very opaque piece of work, And so older audiences were simply not ready. They were used to films being largely stage plays that had been shot on film, They just weren't quite ready.
So it was us kids at the time who truly made this film a hit, because we didn't have all of that burden of film history. And it was, frankly, a lot of people who were, tripping and smoking pot and wanted to get that ultimate trip in a movie theater, which 2001 provided. Is that correct?
Well, you're partly right, although I think that it has been a bit oversold that, everybody was stoned when they watched 2001. What is true is, And Kubrick himself said, my film was saved by teenagers,
He said that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, I heard that he said that. I don't have that in my book. I couldn't verify it independently, but I'm pretty sure he said that. In fact, I think Tony Fruin, his assistant, told me he said that. But in any case, the younger generation, people below 30, lined up. Despite all the negative reviews, they lined up and they were, they lined up at the theater on Broadway, Lowe's Capital Theater, the day after that invitation-only premiere, the one that was a disaster, with 240 people walking out. They lined up down the street to get tickets to see the film, and they never stopped coming. And 2001 ended up being the highest-grossing film of 1968.
Wow, that's incredible.
Mm. Whether or not people were rolling a joint before going in there, who cares in a way? I mean, yes, probably some were, but, I would argue that, 2001 is one of those films where you don't need any pharmaceutical help.
I totally agree. I completely agree. Let's wind down this interview, Michael, by asking you, did Stanley Kubrick or Arthur Clarke, have they ever put on record their thoughts about what they believe the meaning of the film was supposed to be? Did either of those two great artists say, well, here's really what we feel the meaning of 2001, A Space Odyssey, is?
Well, Kubrick himself was asked for his interpretation of the film in a Playboy interview in the fall of 1968. And he referred to Leonardo's Mona Lisa, and he said, he said, what would we think about Mona Lisa today if Leonardo had written on the back of the canvas, the lady is smiling because she's hiding a secret from her lover? And he said, I don't want that to happen to 2001.
Right.
People should bring their own imaginations,
That's a great quote, because, we kind of ruin it. You don't want, it's the whole enigma. What is she? Is that a smile? What is he thinking? You don't want to have it be spelled out for you. That's not what a lot of the great artists, not about that,
Exactly. Hmm. And then, by the way, Arthur was asked by a San Francisco radio interviewer, and also that was in April 68, the month of the release. He was asked, do you think technology is dehumanizing us? And without missing a beat, he said, no, I think it's superhumanizing us. And then he said, in regards to Hal, that whole face-off with Hal, he said, people can make their own interpretations about 2001, and they are all equally valid. But he said, in his opinion, Dave Bowman's victory over Hal was probably a Pyrrhic victory. Which I found to be very interesting, especially in view of our contemporary debate about AI and how it's being used and abused.
Thanks for listening to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for June 2018. Our interview was with Michael Benson, author of Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and The Making of a Masterpiece. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.